Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today my guest is author Philip Garza. Philip's new book, Agents of Order, is a very interesting contribution to American history literature that tells about the author's involvement in the history of industrial unionism and the rise of the industrial worker to prominence in American society. So Philip Garza retired from the International Harvester Company, Case Corporation, on January 1st, of 2001 at the age of 69 with more than 52 years of service. During his industrial career, Philip worked as a semi-skilled operator in the machine shop as an elected official in the United Auto Workers Union as a journeyman skilled tradesman and spent nearly 23 years in the layout inspection building. He received his journeyman's card in August of 1990. Philip also taught geometric dimensioning to engineers and students of engineering at International Harvester and Scott Community College. Philip's commitment to improving worker conditions through the United Auto Workers Union has led to his involvement in American history, and Philip also served in the U.S. Marine Corps during the Korean War. So that said, welcome to the program, Philip.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Wonderful. Well, I have to congratulate you on publishing what I believe is your first book.
Yes, indeed it is.
Well, great. So how did the idea for actually writing Agents of Order come about?
Well, it came through a lifetime of working in an industrial complex and seeing from an early age of age 17 up to the age of 69 of how industrial unions really helped the working class people of America, especially in the industrial environment.
It has really probably at this point come full circle with the changes that we're seeing in a global market at this point. Are you seeing that unions will kind of fall by the wayside with all of the changes?
Well, that depends on many factors. One of them is whether or not the new president and the new administration will be honest and successful in what they campaigned with, the slogan, Buy American.
Mm.
If we can implement this and make it work, I think unions will maintain, if not gain, they will at least maintain their voice in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would love it if you could take us back to the beginning when you were that high school dropout and you began working for International Harvester Company. So take us back to the beginning and then maybe through the years, the last 60 years.
Okay, I can very easily do that. It seems like it only occurred yesterday.
I imagine.
Anyway, as I said, at an early age of age 17, I went to the farm oil plant in Rock Island, which was International Harvester, and I was hired there in November of 1948 in the foundry. And I worked there and was almost immediately approached by the union to join their union. And, of course, I had never really heard about a union. I asked the question, well, what is a union? And, of course, the recruiting union steward says, he thought about it a minute and said, well, the union will keep the foreman off your posterior.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a good idea because I had to put in a probationary period and I wanted some protection. So I immediately said, yes, I will sign the card and join. And he said, sign the card and tomorrow I'll be around to pick up the signed card. And it'll cost you 50 cents a month. So that was the beginning, the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I had some problems there in my several months in the foundry because during my probationary period, which is exactly what it is, a probationary period, and the company had the right to take you off whatever your regular job was and place you whenever they needed you. So I had a problem with the union. I was paying union dues, but I got no protection as a probationary employee. But anyway, aside from that, eventually I got laid off at the foundry, and I worked the second shift at the foundry, and the second shift superintendent advised me to go to the East Moline plant of International Harvester because they were hiring there. So the very next day I went there, and eventually I was hired in at the East Moline International Harvester plant. It had no foundry, but it had a large machine shop and several assembly lines and a large sheet metal and heat treating facilities and so forth. So that began my life work at the East Moline plant of International Harvester, March 15th of 1949.
In Illinois.
In Illinois,
mm-hmm.
That's correct. It was about 7 miles from Rock Island.
Okay. Now, how established was the United Auto Workers Union when you began?
They were not established at all. The union that was in force then was the FEUE, the Farm Equipment United Electrical, which it was claimed by the United Auto Workers that they were communist-dominated. So we went through a lot of skirmishes. The United Auto Workers came to the East Moline plant in early 1949 trying to convince the workers that they should throw off the FEUE union and join a more progressive union, the United Auto Workers. Well, there was a tremendous fight. Cars were turned over. State police was called and so forth.
Oh, wow.
And the United Auto Workers officers who were trying to organize the workers at East Moline were booked for disorderly conduct, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
So that was the beginning of a clash between the two industrial unions.
Well, what was the original structure, the frame? Where did that come from for the original union?
You mean the farm equipment?
Yes.
The electrical?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really certain where it actually started. All I know is that it was firmly entrenched in both the farm wall plant in Rock Island and at the East Moline plant in East Moline.
Hmm.
So, to my way of thinking then, I didn't see how the United Auto Workers Union would ever be able to throw off the FEUE because they were so firmly entrenched.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as I state in my book, the FEUE was its own worst enemy.
How so?
How so is because they were to the point of radical, too radical. They wanted to constantly show the company that they controlled everything. And there was many wildcat strikes and work stoppages and so forth. Now, some of them were necessary because we really had no protection back in those days. We had nothing other than our piecework system. Now, we had good piecework paying jobs, but the only way we could make those jobs pay good was sometimes through militant action. But there was no pensions, no health security,
mm-hmm.
none of the things that workers today or over the years have enjoyed.
So it sounds like the general sentiment of the workers then was that they embraced the change.
They embraced any entity that could better their working life, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The company back in those days in the late 40s was very ruthless. They viewed the blue collar worker as beneath them and treated them as such.
And this International Harvester?
Correct.
Okay.
So it behooved the working men and women to organize, and so they would have a voice.
So how professional was the UAW at handling labor problems?
The UAW?
Mm-hmm.
Well, once the FEUE was no longer in existence, the UAW was very successful. For one thing, when we got our first negotiated contract in 1955, they negotiated in the contract a no-strike clause, which simply meant that before people could strike legitimately, we had to go through a process, and which involved the world headquarters of International Harvester and United Auto Workers from the Detroit officers. And it was a lengthy procedure, but it did bring a procedure, and it also brought order to the shop floor. So I was impressed with the orderliness that was brought about by the United Auto Workers Union.
And obviously the workers were very happy with this.
Well, the workers were divided because there was a very long strike. I happened to be in the Marine Corps at the time,
mm-hmm.
Between 51 and 54. In 52, there was, an 87-day strike under the auspices of the FEUE. And it went on forever and forever, and many workers crossed the picket line. And eventually, the FEUE was broken. All the workers went back to work, and there was no union there.
Okay. So that's how it crumbled, the FEUE.
That's how it crumbled, because the workers, the majority of workers, crossed the picket line, and they lost confidence in the negotiating ability of the FEUE.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to hear about picket lines and strikes. I think that that's what most people, when they think of unions, they don't really understand the history and how important they really are, because what we're typically exposed to is what we see on the media, and it's strikes and that sort of thing.
Yes, it portrays a picture of sheer radicalism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But its original state is a very different, it's very, very different. You know, one aspect that you cover in your book is the daily problems on the shop floor that really the general public, once again, is really unaware of. So what type of problems are we talking about, and why was it important for you to clarify this in your book?
Okay. Let's turn to the heat of summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets very stifling into a plant that's got nothing but steel. Once that steel heats up, it's a lot hotter inside than it is outside. And the company back in those days expected the welders to weld under their hoods without any kind of an exhaust system and very little fans. And the people who ran the blast furnaces had no exhaust systems and very little fans. And of course, when the heat got so hot in the summer and the heat of the machines, it was very oppressive.
Mm.
And the only way that we could get additional fans and exhaust systems installed was to stage wildcat walkouts.
Mm.
And once the workers stopped production, it impressed upon the front office that they had to do something in order to get the workers back to work.
Mm-hmm.
This, again, was under the FEUE.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that was one thing. Another thing, in the cold winter months, the East Moline plant, like most facilities back built in the early turn of the century, they were like big barns. They had big sky-high windows, and during the winter months, when it snowed, the snow would filter in through the windows down in the machine shop and so forth.
Oh, wow.
And the water in the machining centers got very cold, and we had to have water on the cutting tools to keep them from burning up. So the only way that workers could really accommodate themselves was to go upstairs in the locker rooms and fill up their buckets with hot water and pour the hot waters into their machines so their hands wouldn't freeze.
Oh, my gosh.
So this was these kinds of conditions led many times to wildcat strikes. And the only way that the workers could garner anything from the people who sat up front in their nice warm offices to impress upon them that we had real problems in the plant.
It's amazing that the workers were expected to actually work in those kind of conditions. I mean, I don't think that, you know, the general public really realizes how rough those conditions were.
Right. And again, especially the media. The media always portrayed the workers on the picket lines as evil people.
Mm-hmm.
Here those radical people are again striking for more money and more this and more that. And really, many times it had to do with working conditions.
Yes, and it's almost like it was slave labor in this country.
Well, it was rough.
Yeah, yeah.
Indeed, it was rough.
So when did they start changing the entire manufacturing facilities from the more outdated mode into some of the newer structures that we see now?
Well, the East Moline plant never did change.
It didn't.
And the Farmall plant, as far as I know, of course, I only worked several months at the Farmall plant, but I can speak from experience at the East Moline plant. It never did change. They brought about some changes, but insofar as they did put an exhaust system in the welding department, and they did provide more fans, but in trying to heat the plant in the winter months, it was impossible, and they never achieved that. And they put in new paint systems, and they did spend some money. They made an attempt to modernize the facility, but even when I retired in the year 2001, they still had machine centers in the machine shop that were there when I started in the machine shop back in 1949.
You've got to be kidding.
Oh, they were obsolete.
How many workers are at that plant still today?
Oh no, it's been closed. And they tore down, you know, that plant stood mightily on the south shore of the Mississippi River for
mm-hmm.
about 70 years.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2005, it was demolished. The successor to International Harvester, Case Corporation, I believe it's Case New Holland now, moved the combine facility to Nebraska, a non-union facility.
Okay.
So wrecking balls wrecked that plant, and all that exists down there now is a large vacant land that used to house about 56 acres under roof.
Isn't that something? How do you feel about that?
It's sad, very sad. I live only 5 minutes up the hill from the plant, and it only takes me 5 minutes to drive there.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally when I drive along River Drive, I view it, and you talk about a corporate tragedy. This is a corporate tragedy, at least for the workers.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, a lot of workers were put out of work because of that.
Yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good thing that the union, the United Auto Workers Union, did negotiate good pension benefits because a lot of people could retire with their 30 and out, or on a closing agreement that they could retire and grow into the 30 and out.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there was a lot of lost jobs,
mm-hmm.
no question about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you also talk about elected officers and their respected roles in representation. So what really was the chain of command for elected officers and their whole role?
All right. Right at the shop floor level were the union stewards. The union stewards could represent anywhere from 7 people up to 50 or 60. That was the very bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the grievance committeemen. They were zone committeemen, a one man. And the shop was divided into zones. There was 4 zones on the day shift, 2 zones on the second shift, and 1 zone on the third shift. So on the day shift, there were 4 zones. We had 4 grievance committeemen, and each one of them had about 500 people. They would go and confer with the union stewards on grievances pending, and if the grievances were viable, they would prepare them for the first step agenda. And then above the grievance committeemen, there was the president and chairman. At the East Moline plant, the president and the chairman both wore the same hat.
Mm.
So I was president of the local union and chairman of the grievance committee. And then, of course, we had our executive board members,
mm-hmm.
which controlled the activity of the local union.
How many people were in that union?
At one time, there was over 3,000 people.
Wow.
So we had quite a large group of people to represent.
Mm-hmm. That seems to me like it would be incredibly time-consuming, not only to do your work, but to have this whole entire other job.
Oh, it was very time-consuming.
Yes.
When I was president and chairman, I probably spent, I would say, 30 hours a week in the plant, and maybe 10 hours of the 40 at the union hall.
Mm.
And then in addition to that, many times I went into the plant on the second and third shift.
Mm-hmm.
So it was it took a lot of hours.
And you were with the union in that respect right up until retirement?
No. I was there, let's see, I was a union steward, and I was the second vice president, the first vice president, the president and chairman of the local union. And I was defeated for a re-election in 1978.
Mm, okay.
So all the people that I knew over the years, many of them had retired under the provisions of the 30 and out, and then there was a new group being hired and so forth that did not know me as well as the old group did. And, of course, we were not successful in getting back some of the jobs that had been farmed out, so I had lost a lot of credibility.
Mm.
So I went down in defeat in 1978, and I went back to college and eventually got the job that I lasted in for the last 23 years.
Oh, that's right. Now, clearly that was in the 70s that all of that changed around.
Yeah, in 1978, that's when I went back to college. I was working full-time in the machine shop during the days and went back to college 3 hours a night, Monday through Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
I did this for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. That's a full schedule.
Yes, indeed.
You were very devoted to the work, obviously.
Yeah, what's disturbing to me is to hear people say, I used to hear people say, oh, I hate this place, or I hate this job, or I never did hate any job that I ever had there for the 52 years that I spent there.
Mm.
It's terrible for people to spend a whole lifetime in a job that they hate.
Isn't that true? Yeah, that's good to hear that you enjoyed it. Now, when you were there, was there any conditions that were actually made worse by executive management decisions?
Well, you know, we had the disastrous strike of 1979, November 1st till April the 21st of 1980, almost a six-month strike. Executive management went out of the company to hire new people to manage the company. And they got people that didn't understand labor unions and came in and quite frankly says, we're going to show this union who's the boss. And right away it was a very confrontational. And that's the reason that we had such a long, lengthy strike, 79 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very poor management. People that didn't really understand the function of the agricultural implement division and people that didn't understand how to work with labor unions. And so they eventually were let go. All the new people that they hired were let go. And some of the old line International Harvester people, executive management took over. But the damage had been done.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Hi there. Are you looking for new ways to promote your book? Why not consider being interviewed live? With the huge impact internet radio as well as podcasting is making in our society, your voice can now be heard worldwide. Let Juanita at Inside Scoop Live create the necessary steps for you. You will not only receive a web page of your own, but your interview will be available for MP3 download and RSS feed. As well, your interview will be posted on venues such as iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Podcast Alley, and the Inside Scoop Live blog. Go to InsideScoopLive.com today for more information. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Philip Garza. He is the author of Agents of Order, and you can find out more about Philip and his book through the website Lumina.com.
The damage had been done, but in addition to that, neither party really knew that the deep recession that the Farm Equipment Division was going into. And it lasted for many years before the ag imp finally rebounded.
In the 80s?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Very bad.
Mm-hmm. And obviously that affected union workers.
It affected the workers, and a lot of workers lost their jobs. And International Harvester finally went out of business in 1985, where Tenneco, which owned Case Corporation back in those days, bought the ag imp from International Harvester and took over their responsibilities insofar as the detentions and the health security agreements and so forth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what kind of protection did the union workers have when there were massive layoffs like that?
Okay. Way back in 1955, the United Auto Workers started to develop what they called a SUB plan, Supplemental Unemployment Plan. And in 55, they partially achieved what they were after. They got 65% of the workers' pay, and in future negotiations, they increased that up to about 90%. So between unemployment compensation and the supplemental plan, if a worker was laid off, they could draw about 90% of their wages. And just as long as the fund was healthy, they could draw this for up to a year.
That's impressive.
Yes, indeed it was.
Mm-hmm.
You see, back in the early days, and the great labor leader Walter Reuther always accused the auto industry of not proper planning. He said, every time you change over from one model to another without proper planning and thinking, you lay off workers by the thousands. And there they are trying to feed their families,
mm-hmm,
without any source of income. So he was bound and determined to to force the companies into better planning when they changed over their models, and force the company into paying the workers something when they were arbitrarily laid off.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a tremendous advantage for the workers of America.
Absolutely, and that is still in effect with the union.
Well, it was when I retired. Now, I don't know if it. I think it still is in the auto industry, but they're going through
major trials
right now with the government because General Motors and Chrysler and Ford, you know, they're having extreme problems. And,
yes.
And then the unions have to concede. We live in changing times.
Mm-hmm.
And when times change, everybody has to change.
Well, what is the general sentiment in the area that you're in? It's a major auto-producing area in Illinois, you know, up in Detroit, up in there. So living in that area, what's the general mood at this point?
Well, the general mood is that as much as I disagreed with Bush for the last 8 years and just about everything he did, I must say that I agreed with him when he agreed personally, in spite of his party, when he agreed personally to put money into the auto industry to make it survive. And even in the United Auto Workers Solidarity, the president of the United Auto Workers more or less thanked Bush for having that kind of insight.
Mm.
The first time that in 8 years that they ever praised Bush for doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, of course, we were elated when President Obama is putting money into that area.
Mm-hmm.
But they're trying to force the companies and the unions to face up to the table of responsibility to do whatever they must do in order for these companies to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see what happens. You know, a lot of people still buy American-made cars. I've got a 2007 Buick, and I would hate to see General Motors file for bankruptcy.
Right. Yeah. How true. It sounds like a lot of reorganization and planning will go along with the economic help that the auto industry is going to be getting. So do you see that outsourcing and the whole idea of a global market, free trade, the NAFTA agreement, do you think that was kind of the beginning of the end?
Well, in my book, I've outlined it. I know you don't have a copy of my book.
Mm-hmm.
I outlined that the Democratic Party betrayed the industrial workers of America. We had a Democratic president who ramrodded through Congress NAFTA, and in addition to that, both United States senators from the state of Illinois, both Democrats, voted for NAFTA. So the Democratic Party that was supposed to be representing the workers of America sold us out. As far as I'm concerned,
mm-hmm.
and this is something that I can never forgive President Clinton for doing.
Mm. It seems like there were a lot of problems with NAFTA that are now at this point becoming evident.
Yes, indeed. Now, one other thing I'd like to point out is that in the book, this is a story of American politicians who welcome the health security agreements of industrial America corporations and unions. They didn't follow the lead set by other industrial nations of the world, Germany, France, Japan, and others, in developing their own national health. Now, clearly, this put industrial America behind the eight ball when it came to competing fairly with all the other industrial nations of the world.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that industrial America could do this.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely no way.
Why do you think that wasn't a priority?
You mean with our Congress?
Yes.
Well, simply because they were too busy making sure that they would get reelected and building bridges to nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
As more money as they could put back into their area that they represented would make them look good the next time people had to trek to the ballot box.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a tragedy
yeah.
that we don't have term limitations on our members of Congress.
Yes, absolutely.
It's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So at this point, with the changes in government that we're seeing right now, are you feeling positive?
I'm feeling somewhat positive. I was very disappointed that the Republicans had the audacity, after 8 years of spending and spending and spending, and got us to the point where we're bankrupt. The United States is bankrupt. There's no question about it.
Sure, yeah.
But for 8 years, they spent and spent and spent. Now, suddenly, they're jumping on the Democrats and saying, oh, you're spending money that we shouldn't be spending. This is two-faced.
It doesn't really make sense, does it?
It does not.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like a lot of the spending that was happening over the prior 8 years was a lot of personal investments. A lot of people made a lot of money off that spending.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, something else that bothers me is that a lot of industry settles in the South, and when unions try to negotiate down there with the workers, the first thing the companies tell the workers in those areas that unions are crooked and they're no good. And all we have to do is look at the last 5 years of what corporate America has done for people.
Mm-hmm.
Billions of dollars have been lost on pensions and all of the other things that people were saving for.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unions are good for our society. The first thing that Adolf Hitler did in the 30s, the early 30s when he came to power, was rid Germany of labor unions.
Really?
That's the first thing he did.
Well, that's telling right there, isn't it?
It most certainly is.
Mm-hmm.
People do not understand history or don't read history.
Right. And so clearly there was a need for this book.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I'm having a hard time getting my story out because the United Auto Workers Union has a policy that they won't support or advance the cause of any book written by a United Auto Workers worker.
Hmm.
So for the tremendous audience that is out there, there's probably a million and a million and a half active workers and retired workers who would be pleased to know that this book exists. I can't get the word out.
Mm-hmm. Just it is a little harder to market. I wonder why the union won't support that.
I guess it's a policy of theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They figure that if everybody that came along and wanted to write a book, they would be inundated
mm-hmm.
with people wanting to write a book.
Clearly, though, with someone like yourself who spent so many years in and around the union, I mean, and this is a very, very historically documented book. I mean, this, I think there should be an exception, but that's my opinion.
Well, obviously, I feel the same way.
You're right, right. I do want to ask you about outsourcing once again and any strategies that may have been thought about by the UAW and put in place as in regards to outsourcing. Did they foresee this as being an issue?
Well, here in my book, this is a story of an industrial union whose priorities became entangled with wages and benefits rather than job security through contractual language restricting outsourcing of UAW jobs.
Mm.
I think it was a question of priority.
Mm-hmm.
I took twice to the bargaining, to the main table, bargaining table, to the National Negotiating Committee, both in 73 and 76, about the problems we were having of outsourcing. I can give you one example. On our loading dock, we used to load all of our combines on flat cars, or the trucks would come in and our workers would load them on the trucks. Well, sometime before the 76 negotiations, the company decided arbitrarily to hire an outside concern right across the street from the plant to do all the loading of combines. And our workers on the loading dock had to drive the combines across the street and turn that work over to non-union people. And many workers on our loading docks lost their jobs because of that.
Wow.
I took this problem and invited United Auto Workers leaders to the East Moline plant and showed them that. And they told me, you need to take this problem to the 76 negotiations. When I went to the 76 negotiations, I could get no one to really become interested in outsourcing of jobs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I just don't think that the people in power really understood the danger that we were facing through outsourcing of jobs. For example, during the 73 negotiations, we had 43,500 people under the contract to the International Harvester and the UAW. That also included the Canadian workers.
Wow, that's a lot.
I think John Deere had about 33,000.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think John Deere is probably lucky to have 7,000 or 8,000, and I really don't know how many and Teeth Corporation
mm-hmm.
belong or are unionized. There are very few.
Mm-hmm.
Outsourcing.
That's incredible. Now, how it must have been so frustrating dealing with people high up in these companies that really were quite out of touch with what was happening on the floor.
Well, there came a point where the company hired better leaders, and we're concerned about improving the working conditions on the floor. Back in the 40s and 50s, it wasn't. It was like talking to a piece of concrete trying to resolve something.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 60s and 70s, there was a radical change, and they were the leaders of the company were more receptive to the workers.
Mm-hmm.
We had some good plant managers.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Wigner was one, and Roger Behrens was another. These were very good leaders.
And you mentioned several people in your book that were crucial in history, really.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I tried to give credit where credit was due.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also discuss the whole idea of the decline of the middle class through this erosion of American jobs that is happening. Where, at this point, do you think the middle class is headed in this country?
Well, I think if the present trend continues, I think we're going to see most of the middle class erode away. Even people that go to college for 4 years and educate themselves, their jobs are being siphoned off to India and China and others for cheaper wages.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody can't be a doctor or a nurse, and so. Are we going to have a society of the rich and the poor, like Mexico?
I don't know.
It's
interesting to think about, and you know, I've heard from various sources over you know the past several years, really the last 5 years, really predicting that this was going to happen. Maybe not knowing it was going to happen this quickly, but that really the middle class is just at some point going to be a thing of the past. It's going to be the haves and the have-nots.
It seems that we're heading that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it all started, I have to say again, with NAFTA.
With free trade, right.
And there's no such thing as free trade.
Right, very true.
If we have fair trade, that's one thing. But we don't have fair trade.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a one-way street.
Mm-hmm. So, in your opinion, then, what will need to happen to reestablish American manufacturing, job security, and really build a middle class again?
Well, I think.
I mean, that's a huge question.
I didn't get that last question.
No, it's a huge question. What your opinion would be for America to reestablish manufacturing and job security and to rebuild the middle class that at this point is just eroding at such a high rate?
Well, the only way that we can get to that is through good leadership from Congress. Congress is going to have to understand that American industry will always outsource jobs as long as we don't have a national health agreement like the other industrial nations of the world. This is a huge cost factor. So if we can somehow persuade Congress to develop a national health program similar to those that exist in Germany, France, and elsewhere, then maybe we can level the playing field for industrial America, and they would be willing to keep more and more jobs in the United States of America. That's the first avenue of approach.
Right. And I guess for the American public, probably to start purchasing American products once again.
Well, how can we when everything on the racks are made in China?
China, true. Mm-hmm.
There's hardly anything made in. Sure, I think Americans would like to purchase things made in America, but you can't find them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to not laugh, but whenever somebody makes a comment how Americans love things made from China, that's all you see on the racks anywhere you go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Made in China. I don't care what it is, whether it's clothing mm-hmm. or dishes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is made in China.
What is made in America these days? Very little.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Caterpillar still makes a lot of things in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And John Deere makes things in the United States, although they have plants in South America and so.
Very interesting. Well, it will be very telling what happens in the next 5 years, four or five years.
It all depends on what kind of leadership we have.
Yeah.
The president as well as Congress.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, Philip, what's in your future? Are you planning on any more books? What are you doing with your time these days?
Well, right now I'm doing some remodeling on my home.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife and I have a daughter in Arizona, and we also have a daughter in Madison, Wisconsin. We have two grandchildren up north. We do some traveling.
Mm-hmm.
But we kind of like to stay close to home. And we lived in East Moline for 46 years, and we consider East Moline our home. And it looks like we're going to stay here. I don't think we're going to move.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's a beautiful area.
It is. East Moline, you know, it's right, as I said, it's right on the bank of the Mississippi River.
Mm-hmm.
And although we get some snow and ice and so forth in the winter, it's something that, as my wife always says, as long as the roads are clean, we can live with it.
Yeah. Oh, sounds wonderful. Well, it has been really interesting talking with you today, Philip. I want to thank you for coming on to the show and talking about your book and your thoughts of what's happening right now, you know, with regards to manufacturing and unions and this whole global market that we're in.
Well, I think my book is very important for America to read. I just don't have the means and the opportunity to get it out there. Hopefully this will help.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Just getting out there, trying to touch as many people as you can through as many different means definitely will help. So I'm so happy that I got to be a part of that today with you, Philip. And I just wish you all the best and really support your work. This is an incredibly crucial book and very relevant for our time.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You bet. Thank you, Philip. You take care. All right, listeners, that's been Philip Garza. His new book, Agents of Order, is out now. It's on Lumina Press, and you can actually look for Philip's book through Amazon or through the Lumina Press website at lumina.com. So I want to thank you so much for tuning in and listening to this really very interesting interview today with Philip Garza. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.